Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, a reminder, we Zoom on Sunday afternoon, so God forbid something should happen Sunday night. We will be discussing it on Tuesday. This, of course, is our Rethink the Week, where we bring together a panel of fabulous guests to talk about all the events of last week, and there were plenty to the Republican convention, what's happening in Kenosha and places around the country. But before we begin there, we begin with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019, when Lieutenant Colonel Vindman testified before that hearing, and he brought his positions, his courage, his commitment to the country over his commitment to a president, and decided that he had to talk truth. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman assured his father that it would be okay. What we have learned since is that it's not okay for him, for his twin brother, or frankly, for the rest of us. We've been playing the testimony over and over again for months. We will continue to do that until you decide to exercise the franchise in November of 2020, whether you do it by vote by mail, absentee, or vote in person. The words of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Joining us right now for our Rethink the Week panel are three guests. One of our regulars, Dean Spiliotis, is a professor at Southern New Hampshire University. He's a civic scholar and a presidential scholar. He has a blog that's entitled nhpoliticalcapital.com. He's also a regular on NHPR, New Hampshire's public radio. Welcome to the program, Dean.
Hi, Arnie. Good to be with you.
Joining us also is Stephen Pimper. He is a professor at UNH Manchester. He is a senior fellow at the Carsey Institute. His area of expertise is poverty and homelessness. He also is a very opinionated fellow, which is why we love him, because we know with Stephen, you will know exactly what he thinks. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Thank you, Arnie, I think. Glad to be here.
You think, oh, no, trust me, that's why we love you. And an old friend, I knew him when he was a Republican from Portsmouth, a very active Republican, frankly. He's an attorney. He now works in the state of New York. Let me welcome to the program Paul Peter Jessup. Now, Paul Peter, are you still connected with the Republican Party, or have you sort of severed your ties like a lot of Republicans, in part because of Donald Trump and maybe some of the other things that have been happening within the GOP camp?
I have completely severed all ties with the Republican Party, so I am clearly a recovering Republican, and I just find it mind-boggling that 90% of Republicans support Donald Trump. This is not a party. This is cult personality.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So there are sort of two ways I want to begin this, and one, I want to sort of start with my tweet of the week. And I saw this last night, and Oliver Griswold wrote, "This week feels like all the nightmares are coming true." And I'm going to start with you, Stephen Pimper. The GOP convention, the Trump convention, was amazing theater, but it wasn't amazing theater that embraced democracy. It seemed to be an amazing piece of theater that embraced authoritarianism. Everything that Donald Trump did seemed to suggest that he wasn't looking for your vote. He just wanted to sort of reassure his base that he owned this space, that the White House wasn't our house, it was his house. And the more I go back and look at it, it felt so uncomfortable, but even as it felt so uncomfortable, he actually got a bump from the Trump convention. And that sort of surprised me.
Well, I mean, a couple of things, I guess. One is that I've only seen a single post-convention poll. Any single standalone poll is not going to give us useful information. It's typical. I know that we live in a world in which there are all sorts of atypical things, but it's typical to expect each party to get a little bit of a bump after the convention, and then often it will sort of return back to the norm. I think the more interesting thing for me as I think about both the Democratic and Republican conventions is the extent to which the Democrats really did seem to be trying to build as broad a tent as possible and to explicitly ask recovering Republicans and still active Republicans to find a way to vote for the Biden ticket. And as you pointed out, the extraordinary narrowness for the most part of the Republican convention, I think part of that though is a reflection of the anomaly of the American political system itself, right? That is, think back to the 2016 election, right? How does the guy who gets 3 million fewer votes than the other candidate wind up winning? Because we've got this weird electoral college thing, right? And because of sort of the way in which humans have organized themselves, we get Democrats concentrated in single places. They need to reach out more broadly in order to win. Republicans have a less complicated puzzle to put together. I'm not sure that the strategy was the right one, but you can see the logic of it in the system itself.
So, Dean, I'm looking at an article at Jacobean or Jacobean, whatever it is, and the title of the article was "Republicans Run Toward Their Base, Democrats Run Away from Theirs," and you kind of heard a little bit of the answer to that by what Steve just said, talking about how they're trying to expand their base, they want to bring more diversity in, they want to sort of moderate their message. And what you saw with the Republicans was just incredibly hardcore. I mean, they may have brought out a number of black speakers to seem to soften their image. But for the most part, you almost felt like they were tokens, you know, that even the one woman who sort of seemed to be the most eloquent, Alice Johnson, I think her name was, she was the most eloquent, I think, of all the speakers. She actually never said vote for Trump. I just want to remind you that she never actually said that. So as I'm looking at the way the Republicans crafted their message versus the Democrats, I'm wondering if it's smart that the Democrats didn't actually talk to their base. It's not that their base won't show up, but let me suggest something to you, Dean, and that's this, that whenever I hear people talk about like healthcare for all, guess what? The vast majority of Americans want Medicare for all. Whenever I hear people talk about raising the minimum wage to $15, the vast majority of Americans want to raise the minimum wage to $15. A lot of those issues that they sort of are afraid to complete the sentence on aren't just appeals to the base, but they're actually appeals to the vast majority of Americans who actually think that that's not a bad idea. So I'm just wondering if you want a zealous turnout in the general election, what's the strategy, the right strategy, Dean?
Well, there's no way to know up front. We'll find out in a few months. I've heard both arguments. I've heard the argument that Steve made that this was an attempt by Democrats to piece together as large as a coalition as possible. The assumption being that, you know, progressives more than anything want Trump out. That combined with some signaling by Bernie Sanders that he may have better rapprochement with the Biden folks than Hillary Clinton did with him. And I just think that's their strategy. And I think they believe that, you know, right or wrong, and we'll see if they're correct. I think their belief is that, you know, if Biden had talked about the Green New Deal and Medicare for all and all of that, that would have played into some sort of Trumpian trap to paint Biden as an extremist. Now what the Trump folks are trying to do is paint him as the puppet of extremists. You know, they can't really label him as an extremist because he didn't adopt those positions, you know, verbally, but they can say that he's still, you know, still captive to these interests, and that, you know, their argument is that they want voters to believe that, you know, AOC and the squad are the ones who are really running the party, and they believe that that would be a losing argument for Biden. You know, they may be wrong in that calculation, you know, this is going to be a mobilization election. I mean, I guess there are people out there who are still trying to make up their mind, as hard as that may be to comprehend at this point. You know, you sort of know one way or the other. You either have to like or not like what you've seen for the last 4 years. But, you know, I guess there is a belief that some folks are persuadable. I think the Trump folks' attempt to scare particularly suburban, moderate suburban women to vote for him, I'm not, you know, given what we saw in 2018, I don't know how believable that's going to be at this point. That's what they're trying to do. I'm not sure it's necessarily going to work. It's, you know, Biden needs all the folks who stayed home in the swing states in 2016. And if you look particularly at African-American voters, you look at the drop from Obama in 2012 to Clinton in 2016 in some of those key states. If Biden can get back even 60 or 70% of that lost vote, he'd be in reasonably good shape in the swing states. But, you know, I think you and Stephen have kind of staked out the two possibilities for the Democrats. And we'll find out which one was the correct strategy in a few months.
So, Paul Peter, did you watch the Republican convention?
I watched portions of it. I think I have Trump anxiety. I talk with my primary about that pretty regularly. So I read headlines, and I saw the clips after the fact, and there was only so much I can watch of it. And I guess what I walked away from the tone is they talked about law and order, but this is Trump's America. The place we find ourselves at in this country is due to the tone and the approach of Donald Trump. He made this mess. He has not shown himself to be a leader. And so I was thinking of one of the Shakespeare plays, Bowed Too Much. Everything that he is responsible for, he is now trying to project onto Joe Biden. And if Joe Biden's going to pull this off, I think that there has to be a response to every charge that Donald Trump makes, period.
About Paul's suggestion that the strategy of the Biden campaign ought to be either to respond to every charge that the Trump administration is making, or to at least be more responsive to those charges. And I'm not sure. I don't know that I've got the right answer to me, but it seems to me that we are living in a moment when there is one giant thing that is the heart of everything, and that is the pandemic. And it seems to me that hammering that home, and the fact that you are trapped in your home, or you are unemployed, or you can't pay the rent and are about to be evicted, or you don't have enough food and you can't send your kids to school, everything that is wrong in your life right now is because of the incompetence of this administration that it demonstrates over and over and over again. And my instinct, right, and there's probably a reason no one has ever hired me to advise their campaign, but my instinct is, you know what, let all of the rest of that be noise and hammer home that one main point in hopes that that is what brings people out and causes them to make that connection.
Go on, Ken. What?
I was just going to say it's a great idea that Stephen has, because interestingly, one thing that Trump barely mentioned in the whole week of convention is the pandemic. And it is, as Stephen said, it's one thing that every American is suffering with, but Trump doesn't notice it. I mean, you don't even have to go to describing Trump as tone deaf to the rest of our needs. All you have to do is raise the issue of the pandemic, and it's making my life miserable. And so I'm not going to vote for somebody who has not only screwed that up so badly so far, but who continues to be engaging in super spreader events and encouraging other people to go out maskless. And if he's elected for 4 more years, you could see the pandemic going on for 4 more years.
Dean, let me bring you in, because you guys did not listen to my show on Friday. Because if you listened to my show on Friday, exactly what Stephen said, we said that over and over and over again, Stephen. What we said was the pandemic is the economy. The pandemic is the economy. And what you saw, Dean, during that GOP convention was that it was almost like we're past the pandemic. The pandemic is like yesterday's problem. It's not today's story. And in a lot of ways, as Donald Trump keeps insisting that there's a disconnect between the pandemic and the economy, that there isn't really a pandemic that we are experiencing, I hate to say it to you, but going back to school is reinforcing there is a pandemic. Going back to college is reinforcing there is a pandemic. We mentioned last week that UNC, 31% of the UNC students tested positive for COVID. And then we just saw how many employers have announced that they're letting go thousands and thousands of workers. MGM is letting go, I think, one third or one quarter of all their staff. You're seeing it happening everywhere. So whatever he is saying, Donald Trump, it's not connecting with real people's lives.
Well, and you know, there's always a danger. There is a kind of wild goose chase element to trying to keep up with all of the stuff that Trump is going to throw at the Biden campaign. A lot, you know, some of it is like redirection. Some of it is distraction. Trump likes to look for whatever's going to work at a given moment for that day's particular news cycle. I mean, he literally, you know, calibrates this stuff on an hour by hour basis in terms of what the cable news channels are talking about what's trending. He clearly pays a lot of attention to what is trending on Twitter. It makes sense that the Biden folks would want to stay focused on the pandemic. We don't know where we're going to be in November. If there is this much discussed fall wave or another spike and the economy continues to drag and people are getting laid off, that, you know, it's going to be almost insurmountable, I think, for Trump, even if there are, are continued protests in a couple of the cities around the U.S. like we're seeing now. So, you know, part of it is going to be circumstantial. But I also think there's a danger for the Biden folks to, you know, I mean, they always have rapid response. There are always going to be people in the campaign that respond to everything that the Trump folks throw out, but they need to be disciplined with their message. And certainly the pandemic and the economy, I think, you know, those are going to be continue to be, I think, the two biggest issues facing voters. You know, this, security stuff and the, you know, the trying to scare people in the suburbs. I mean, that's going to be around too. We're going to continue to hear that because I think Trump believes, right or wrong, that that's valuable for him politically. But the Biden campaign should stay focused on the key issues, which are the pandemic, the economy, and then you can also have this discussion about, you know, reform and, you know, police reform and you know, racial justice and all of those issues.
Let me just say something. Hold on. So I agree with Stephen. I agree with Dean. I keep saying it's the pandemic. It's the economy. It's the pandemic. It's the economy. You wed the two together. They're like attached at the hip. They can't separate. I think it's only going to get worse. I don't think the pandemic is going to get better. I think more people are going to lose their job. They're going to suddenly realize that the extra $300 that Donald Trump has thrown into the mix for unemployment benefits right now, about five or six states have said yes to that, but they really haven't resolved that. So I think here's the cover that Joe Biden has, and tell me whether I'm right or wrong here, Paul Peter. And that is that I think that what the NBA did and what the sports teams have done by basically sort of, you know, boycotting and deciding to actually strike and not play their games and to draw attention to this, you've never seen sports teams do this. And the sports teams that are doing this are sports teams that, we, as you and I both know, the biggest players are Black men, okay? And they are suddenly realizing that this is also their moment. And in a lot of ways, what's going on in places like Portland, what's going on in Minneapolis, what's going on in Kenosha, I think the fact that the sports teams are really stepping up, they are addressing the Black Lives Matter and the corrosiveness of racism. And to some extent, they've taken a little bit of the heat off of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Am I crazy by thinking that? But I think in a lot of ways, they're helping to redirect the message because they are such individuals of prominence.
I would say let's keep the larger picture in mind. Donald Trump is not trying to win the popular vote. He's looking to win some key states. And so when I hear that the message has to be focused on the pandemic, why is Donald Trump only down in Wisconsin by a point? Why is Michigan competitive? Why is Pennsylvania being competitive? The Biden people have not focused on this one issue. Why do people support Donald Trump? My next, and to underscore my previous point, yes, he has to, and I believe there does have to be a core message, but every lie that Donald Trump puts out there has to be responded to. Repeat a lie often enough and it becomes the truth. Donald Trump, if you listen to him carefully, has now said, but for me, this pandemic would have been even worse and people are gonna buy that. And so everything that man comes out of his mouth, it needs to be challenged. Maybe not by Biden, but there does need to be an orchestrated strategy to deal with it. And keep in mind, this is not about the popular vote. It's about key states. It's about those delegates.
So, Stephen, it seems to me it's like whack-a-mole, because Donald Trump lies about everything. The lie changes in the same day, let alone the same week. I think part of it is, but there are themes to Donald Trump's lies. And so while you can't necessarily, as Paul Peter is suggesting, respond to every lie, you kind of know where the lies are going. And there's like chapters to the lies. And what I think that Kamala, the Democratic Party, and Joe Biden haven't done is given people in a repetitive and easy to remember way all the facts that deny the lies. We haven't heard them enough. I mean, every week there's a new number of people that are dying from this disease, a new number that's happening. But I think in some ways they haven't figured out what the strategy is, so that as soon as we mention a certain topic, the real factual number comes into people's head, not the lie that Donald Trump has basically been repeating over and over again for months. They haven't figured out the art of repetition.
Two things, I think. One is, you know, and I mean, I'm arguing with myself here. I don't necessarily disagree with anything that you or Paul has just said. I part of the challenge, right, is that people keep in mind that most people are only now beginning to pay attention to the election, right? People tune in, right? We are not normal. And people tend to tune in very, very late. And it is the least informed voters who are the ones who are most likely to not be sure how they are going to vote, and who are most in need of the correction to the lies that come out of the president's mouths. And I mean, this is just sort of, I'm always frustrated by how much attention we spend on the least informed and least engaged citizens. I don't know the way around that, but that's always frustrating to me. The second point that I want to layer in here is that we are having this conversation as if this is going to be an election like any other, and people are going to go out to vote, and it'll be slightly more complicated in some places maybe than others, but it's by and large going to be a free and fair election, and we will see what happens, and you want to conduct your strategy in that way. I see no earthly reason to operate on the assumption that we are walking toward anything that resembles a free and fair election. And how we deal with that is at least as important as the ordinary kind of strategy that a campaign would be engaged in.
So, Dean, as I'm listening to Stephen, I think he's absolutely right. This election is going to, first of all, it's not going to be an election day. It's going to be an election month. Second of all, it's going to feel very different from any election we've ever had. I have never voted absentee in my life, Stephen, in my life. And I am now, I've got the application out for the primary and for the general election. I'm listening, Dean, to the stories about the United States Postal Service, and I'm obviously worried about that. So I'm thinking I'm going to hand deliver it to my town clerk. I'm going to completely avoid the United States Postal Service. But that's only possible in certain states. That's not universally possible in every state. I'm wondering if what they're doing with the United States Postal Service is actually a benefit to the Democrats, because that isn't just about voting for a lot of people. It is about a lot of things for a lot of people, whether it's a check, whether it's your drugs, whether it's the if you live in rural America, it's that last lag when you order something on Amazon. I'm wondering if there's a way to say they are using the post office because they want to hurt your vote. What they're doing is hurting you, Dean.
Yeah, well, and I think a lot of that started to come out in the immediate aftermath of some of the initial moves by the head of the Postal Service to, you know, remove the sorting machines and drop boxes and cut back on overtime, all of that. I think we started to hear a lot of stories of, people getting, critical medical deliveries days late, live chicks. Who knew? I didn't know that live chicks were sent in the mail, arriving, hundreds of them having died in the shipment because they were delayed. Food spoiling, rats crawling over boxes because there's people shipping food that is just sitting in bins. So all these stories started to come out. And I think that there's, in part, the outcry, I think, it may not have reversed all of the shenanigans, but I think it at least brought it to a stop for now. It's hard to know exactly the extent of the damage. You hear such varying assessments about the capacity of the Postal Service, but it's obviously a concern. There were a lot of Republican politicians who were upset with Trump because there are a lot of Republican districts and states where the mail-in vote is critical. A lot of the sort of rural vote is more conservative. And those folks are going to want to vote as well. So, it was another one of these sort of classic moments where Trump has a particular pet peeve and he acts on it without really thinking through what the consequences are.
So, Paul Peter, what I think is interesting about the mail service is that the mail service is the most urgent and necessary in rural America. And the reason I say that is, how we're talking about what's going on with schools and whether you're going to go online or whether you're going to have in-person classes and whatever's going to happen. And even if you live in rural America, you think, well, COVID hasn't come to me. We're going to have in-person. We're fine. And then all of a sudden, all you need is two cases. And then they shut down even the rural schools, okay? So what I think is fascinating about the Postal Service is that what I think the Republicans don't quite appreciate, or at least Donald Trump doesn't, is that not only is the United States Postal Service essential in rural America, but they don't have the alternative of the kind of high quality online access that more urban America has. So if there is an appeal to the places where Donald Trump has historically done well, I think it turns out that what's happening with education and what's happening with the post office, that's a twofer that makes you go into rural America and says, he doesn't get you. Paul Peter, he doesn't get you. We do.
That's exactly right. This is such a strong issue for Democrats, and I don't hear it being argued enough. Here you can go to a Trump voter and appeal directly to their pocketbook, delayed checks, prescriptions that you desperately need. This is something tangible. The virus is not tangible to a lot of people. This is tangible. And it goes back to rebutting everything that Donald Trump does. He says that the post office is inefficient, that it's corrupt, it's this, it's that. Here's an opportunity to rebut it with that message, and it would work.
Well, and I also think that the other thing that's going to be fascinating is I'm looking at The Hill, and it says battle over COVID-19 school openings goes to court. So now we've got, what's really frightening is that everyone doesn't know what to do, Stephen, when it comes to schools. We were just talking before the show began, what is UNH doing when it comes to, the opening of the UNH campus? We know what SNU is doing. They're going all online and they announced it months ago. But that's at the college level. When you're talking about elementary school and middle school, you're not just talking about the option of online or in class. You are talking about what the hell do parents do if they have to work. And not everyone has the convenience to be able to say, I'm working for Pinterest or I'm working for Google and I can work at home. They actually have jobs where they have to physically, damn it, show up. They're fixing cars, they're doing whatever. So I think the whole school thing is going to be so fascinating because people want resolution, but the only thing you're going to get out of schools is chaos. Because there is no answer, and that's because we haven't addressed the pandemic.
And, you don't have to look at too many other countries around the world to see the ways in which we could have done this better, right? But that would have required a national response led by public health experts rather than the manner in which it was conducted, right? If we had sort of closed down like Spain, if we had refrained from encouraging states to open up freaking restaurants, for heaven's sake, right? Given what we know about the virus, worst thing you can possibly do is be indoors in an enclosed space with poor circulation with people having their mouths open and talking, right? Worst thing you can possibly do, we know this by way of transit. We've done everything wrong. And as is always the case, the people who are going to suffer most are people who are already most vulnerable.
Yes, yes. All right, everyone. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. We'll take a break and we'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1907. That was the day labor leader Luisa Moreno was born in Guatemala City. As a young woman, she fought for the admission of women into Guatemalan universities. After attending journalism school in Mexico City, Luisa moved to New York with her husband and worked as a seamstress. Outraged by low pay, racial discrimination, and poor working conditions, she led organizing efforts on the job. During the Great Depression, she worked as a full-time union organizer, first with the AFL, organizing black and Latina cigar rollers in Florida. But she also became active with the Communist Party and joined CIO efforts to organize cannery workers. Luisa led unionizing efforts of pecan shelling women workers in San Antonio, Texas, and then of cannery workers in Los Angeles. In 1938, Luisa helped organize the Spanish-speaking People's Congress. During World War II, she fought against discrimination in hiring of Mexicans in oil and war-related industries. In the 1940s, she became centrally involved in high-profile legal defense cases of Mexican-American youth prosecuted on frame-up charges. These included work around the 1942 Sleepy Lagoon case and then of victims of the Zoot Suit riots a year later. She continued union work in California, helping to organize and represent walnut pickers. By 1950, she was caught in the crosshairs of the McCarthy-era witch hunts. Luisa was targeted by Operation Wetback and offered citizenship status in return for testimony against radical labor leader Harry Bridges. When she refused, she faced deportation on the accusation that she had once been a member of the Communist Party. She returned to Guatemala and continued organizing workers throughout Central America. Luisa Moreno died in Guatemala in 1992. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. Our panelists are Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, Stephen Pimpere from UNH Manchester, and he's also with the Carsey Institute, and Paul Peter Jessup, an attorney in New York and a former Republican. So at the end of the first half, we were talking about everyone going to court because of schools. And what is so interesting to me, Paul Peter, is that we've got the teachers' unions who are, and I'm going to read right from the Hill, the teachers' unions are waging court fights across the country aimed at unwinding what they say are unsafe and politically motivated timetables for reopening schools. Right, that's on one side. At the same time, Paul Peter, lawsuits are flying from the opposite direction, where parents in several states, including New York, Massachusetts, and Oregon, are saying that, you know, this web-based teaching alternative is not working for us. We want you to physically open schools. It's like a circular firing squad, Paul Peter. Everyone's blaming everyone else. And I think the one thing that the Biden and the Harris sort of, you know, campaign can say is, you know why you're shooting each other? Because we haven't dealt with the pandemic. And as long as the pandemic is raging, there is no correct answer.
Well, as you're saying that, what I'm thinking about is chaos, and this is effective for Donald Trump, and he'll continue to play on it. And the focus is on teachers suing, parents suing. And the focus, of course, should be on Donald Trump. And I'm reminded by his rather arrogant comment when he was running for president, I can shoot someone on Park Avenue and people would still love me and they'd still vote for me. And when you think about all the chaos that exists, if you think about the thousands and thousands and thousands of people that have died, if you think about the millions of jobs that have been lost because the pandemic has been so incompetently handled, what do we see in the polls? We consistently see Trump can still pull this off.
Dean, chaos is an advantage for Donald Trump. There is, in fact, he foments chaos. I mean, if most presidents want to tap down the chaos. Most presidents want to bring about resolution. Most presidents want to ensure the safety and the security of everyone, whether they live in Portland or whether they live in Florida. Donald Trump is the exact opposite, Dean. He wants more chaos. He wants, and frankly, he wants more hurricanes. He wants more fires. He's actually almost ecstatic that climate change has brought about this sort of disruption in what we, you know, traditionally have called the weather. And that's in part because of the chaos. He then can ensure that he can predict an outcome. And the only outcome he wants is not stability, but his reelection, Dean.
Well, what's so strange is he's running as though he's not president. He's running as though he's an outsider who has no connection to policy outcomes we've seen over the last 4 years. It's really, really an odd thing to watch. You know, he's almost as though he's arguing against himself. That's just sort of his natural stance. He feels more comfortable doing that. You know, I saw clips over the weekend of Trump saying that the minute he's inaugurated in 2017, cities would be safe again and peace would return to you know, all the different areas that were experiencing any kind of turmoil. He's saying the same exact thing now. I mean, literally, the language is almost identical. It's as though the last 4 years have not transpired and he bears no responsibility for them. You know, the question is, will voters buy that? Or will they make decisions based on the more traditional notion of retrospective voting? You know, the, if you want to reduce it to Reagan, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Or at least some sense of referendum on the incumbent. So it's really an odd thing to watch. It seems to be the only way that he can kind of engage the process. He's not really interested in talking about, you know, his own record or about, you know, he's been asked now probably three or four times his plans for the second term. And if you read his, if you read the transcript of his answers, they're just absolute gibberish. And that's just he's just not, doesn't have any interest in that.
Why do you think it's possible for voters, even Republicans, Trump voters, to accept this notion of him putting himself up as if he's not the president, you know, decrying all these bad things are happening, and it's as if it's not on his watch? How does he get away with that? Who's buying this and why?
Well, can I just weigh in here? Because I've been thinking a lot about that. He has run against the very government he's in control of since the minute he took office. He has never embraced governing. He's never embraced policy. He's never embraced democracy. He's never sort of showed respect for the institutions of government. In fact, he's tried to destroy them. So in a lot of ways, what I get the feeling of Stephen is that he has been running against the very government he's in charge of. So for him now to run for reelect and run as an outsider, he's been an outsider for 3.5 years, Stephen. That's exactly how he's packaged himself. And you know what? Congress has helped him, because Congress hasn't really passed anything of substance the entire time he has been president. The only thing that has happened in Congress is that the Senate under Mitch McConnell has rubber stamped every appointment to judge. And then what has he done? He's done everything through executive orders. Otherwise, if you want to look at, you know, what is the result of Congress, basically it's Zippo.
Yet another indication of the ways in which the Madisonian U.S. Constitution has failed us, right? It was a system that was designed very carefully on the assumption that it would prevent the formation of political parties and that people would defend their institutional interests rather than their partisan interests. It is a system that is literally unable to function in an era of hyper-polarized parties because of precisely what you said. Instead of the Senate asserting its powers in order to check the executive, it is aligning with their partisan interests and abandoning their institutional interests. And, you know, part of what's happening here, right, the lack of the agenda for the second term, right, literally the party not even putting together a platform, right, is because Trump is an authoritarian at heart. I think we can all now start to see the ways in which that is not hyperbole, right, and is interested in power for the sake of power. There's no interest whatsoever in governance. There's power for the sake of power. It is profiteering. It is advancing himself, his friends, and his family, and nothing beyond that. And, you know, we are, you know, we've, if you look at mortality estimates, we've maybe lost 250,000 people at this point to COVID-19, right? We have the rest of us, right? Many of us more or less survived a first Trump term. I wonder about our ability to survive a second one. And the fact that we are talking about this potentially being a competitive election seems to me to underline the utter failure of the system. And should we emerge from the end of this, we've got to figure out a way to update and revise the Constitution so that it is more democratic.
So this is what scares me. And Dean, and then I'll shoot to you, Paul Peter. And that is, I saw a story at CNN. And the story at CNN to me seemed to speak to really what is really frightening about this election. And the headline was the following, Dean: top U.S. general tells Congress the military won't play a role in the 2020 election. Have you ever heard a general even mention that there is a role for them to play in the 2020 election? Have you ever thought that they would have to utter a statement to that effect? What is so tragic is that that statement needs to even be uttered, because there is now an assumption that he may in fact try to not leave and call on the military to support him.
Yeah, I think if I'm correct, I think that was General Milley who said that. And I think he's still smarting from the whole Lafayette Square
Bible
clearing. Yeah. The whole disaster for Trump, and he had to apologize after that. I think he was also responding. I think Trump had made some comments in the last week about sending law enforcement to polling places. And so I think he was just trying to nip that in the bud in advance. But you're right. It's on its face, it's just a bizarre thing to have to hear the military say in advance of election. I've never heard anything like that before, for sure. Not in this country.
Do you think need the military to be there to protect the democracy in the election? In other words, if Trump has his vigilantes and maybe his Vortec troops that were out there in Portland, might we actually need a real army or National Guard or something to protect the elections from Trump's goons?
Well, but let me just read you. I want to shoot to Paul Peter. This is what Milley said. America's most senior general, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, told members of Congress that the military will not play a role in November's election and won't help settle any disputes if the results are contested. Quote, the Constitution and laws of the U.S. and the states establish procedures for carrying out elections and for resolving disputes over the outcome of elections. I do not see the U.S. military as part of this process. In the event of a dispute over some aspect of the elections, by law, U.S. courts and the U.S. Congress are required to resolve any disputes, not the U.S. military. I deeply believe in the principle of an apolitical U.S. military. Now, Paul Peter, that's what Milley wrote, and that's what Milley said on Friday, okay? Again, shocking that he would even have to utter that is beyond belief. But let me just say something. Yes, Paul Peter?
It is shocking. On the other hand, I find it reassuring, and I find it reassuring for this reason. If you had to remove Donald Trump using the military, then the military is tainted. It now becomes political. If the military in some way were perceived as supporting Donald Trump, it's tainted. This general, based on what you just read, is telling Congress, do your damn job, grow some spines, stand up to this man. This is what you need to do. This is not the military's place to do it. So in one sense, I'm reassured by that.
You actually think Congress is going to grow a spine, though, between now and the election? I mean, I'm a little chilled to feel like I have to rely on that.
I think the general's point is this. It's the responsibility of Congress to step up to the plate and do its job. With that said, we should talk about I'm getting a little off topic here. We should talk about Mitch McConnell's role as Senate Majority Leader and five vulnerable Republican senators who may lose their seat. Mitch McConnell should be part of that election. Susan Collins should lose re-election because she supports Mitch McConnell, and no one talks about that.
So as I'm reading this and saying this, he did, by the way, Milley said that it's the responsibility of the courts, i.e. the Supreme Court, as well as the Congress. So if nothing else, he sort of gave us two responses here. But what I really do see is what's going to be happening all over the country is that the courts are going to be weighing in. Remember Bush v. Gore? Well, now figure out there's going to be about 70 Bush v. Gores. That's exactly what we're looking at, you guys. We're not looking at like one time that someone's going to go to court in one state. We're going to see people going to court in many places, in many states. I mean, so again, the resolution of this election is going to be something that the court is going to have to weigh in on, and we're going to see this happening. But let me just say something that is terribly chilling. What we know is that President Trump is going to Kenosha on Tuesday. Who is he going to meet with on Tuesday, Dean Spiliotis? He is going to be meeting with the cops. What did we hear about the union? And I'm not sure whether this is true or not, because I keep hearing differing messages that the New York City police chiefs have basically sort of told Mayor de Blasio to step down. And the implication is that the police unions are now endorsing Donald Trump. So we actually do have a form of military that may not be the Milley military, but when you put on a uniform and you call yourself a cop, that has kind of a military feel to it, Dean Spiliotis. And what we're seeing is that there now is a real line of demarcation between the cops and then the rest of us. And I think that's pretty scary for me.
Yeah, no, it's clear that Trump sees law enforcement as a key, local law enforcement as a key potential source of support. And, you know, it's going to be fascinating to see, you know, what choices he makes in Wisconsin in terms of who he meets with, how they publicize it, what kinds of counter demonstrations occur, et cetera. I mean, it's not a no risk proposition to do something like this. And then on top of that, you have, there's certainly pressure on Joe Biden to step it up and get involved in this as well in some way, either in Minnesota or Portland or himself go out to Wisconsin. It'd be interesting to see if Trump even makes a pretext of some sort of olive branch to Black Lives Matter or the protesters, or if he uses that as a kind of a foil to build support among law enforcement.
Well, what I'm seeing, Stephen Pimper, is that Donald Trump is being brilliant here. What does he do? He goes down to like Louisiana and Texas. He's surveying the damage. He's talking about all the things he's going to do. He's going to bring in food. He's going to bring in like all the support. So he's going to bring stability and security from Hurricane Laura. Then he's going immediately for Hurricane Laura on Tuesday. He's going to go to Kenosha. Basically, he has not made any implications that he's going to go meet with any African-Americans or Black Lives Matter or the family of the person who was shot in the back 7 times. What he has told everyone is that he's going to meet with law enforcement and survey the damage from recent demonstrations that turned violent. He wants to come in and bring the cameras with him and the national media with him, Stephen Pepere, so they can see the damage. And then he's going to point to who damaged that city, who damaged that building, who hurt those cops. He's not going to talk about the sort of the lack of sort of rational response on the part of the cops when it comes to African-Americans. He's going to basically sort of say, prop up the cops and point to the damage, and he's going to connect the dots for the American people.
Well, and it's, I mean, he did this, I think it was the recent New Hampshire speech, in which he bemoaned the extent to which police are concerned about the well-being of people in their custody. Right, and this is, I mean, it goes back to the campaign itself, right? It's like, you see them hold their hands when they put them in the car, maybe you shouldn't hold your hands, right? He is in front of audiences of law enforcement, encouraged violence against citizens by agents of the state, over and over and over and over and over and over again, right? This is nothing new. At some point, right, one is obligated to believe him, right? That that's who he is, that he means this, that he would like to see armed agents of the state and vigilantes enact violence against people that he doesn't like, who are disproportionately people of color, right? He's a neo-Nazi, he's a fascist, he's a racist, right? Always has been, we've known this for decades, I say as a former New Yorker. The problem is now he has the power of the state and he is enjoying it very much. And that, I think, is the much scarier bit.
All right, so Paul Peter, a friend of mine sent me something that he saw on Twitter. This is from a group called New Hampshire Nationalists, okay? And this is what it said. This is a tweet that just came out maybe about 2 days ago. Attention, leftists, Marxists, communists, the N-word, rioters, BLM, faggots, Jews, etc. Okay? This is, notice the attention. And this is what it read. I can't even read it because I'm like freaking out. If you come to New Hampshire and harass us, attack us, harass our women, or target our businesses, we will defend ourselves and you will get shot. We are armed to the teeth in our little state and we don't F around. Consider that your warning. That just came out 2 days ago. Now, someone wrote me and said, so if I am out there picketing and I'm wearing a mask and I'm in front of a building, am I an out-of-state leftist, Marxist, communist, N-word rioter, or am I an in-state leftist, Marxist, and will I still be shot? This, Paul Peter, is just frightening.
It is frightening, but let's keep in mind that the FBI does have a watch list, and these people are being monitored, they're being tracked. The people who run those organizations are listed with the FBI. I'm pretty confident of that. You have the work of the Southern Poverty Law Center who keeps track of these groups. And for all we know, this is three people who are causing this problem. And they could be three people from out of state. We don't know that. And good people are going to continue to do what good people do, which is going to protest peacefully. And they are going to be an example of courage and righteousness and doing the right thing.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. Thank you so much for this Rethink the Week. It's exhausting. It's frightening. I wish there was a good news story I could give you, but I think the best news of the week was when you saw the sports team step up and actually sort of find their political voice and bring Black Lives Matter into their world and make sure people understand that this is an important moment for them as well.
I just want to thank Paul for saying that last bit, because it's the only hopeful thing I have heard anyone I have spoken with say in the last week or so. And it's, I appreciate it, just sort of that reminder that, you know, we can we can take seriously those threats, but at some point we choose to continue to go on and stand for what is good and right, and that we need to focus on that courage. And so I appreciate that reminder a lot.
Thank you.
So Dean Spilios of Southern New Hampshire University, Stephen Pepere from UNH Manchester and the McCarthy Institute, and my good friend, attorney Paul Peter, former Republican, and now I guess feeling somewhat abandoned in this conversation, but obviously still finding his political voice. Thank you so much for our Rethink the Week. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. See you tomorrow.
Take this message.